From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Cue the music. On Monday, the Democratic National Convention kicks off in Denver. If all goes as planned, everything will happen on cue. The following week, the Republicans convene in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Same deal. Some 15,000 journalists are expected to attend each convention. But why? It's been more than 30 years since the last nomination was contested, and even the vice presidential picks are announced in advance. So barring injury, insanity, or acts of God, no news will be broken. Cue the balloons. And now, cue the discussion about how predictable the conventions are. Jack Schaefer is Slate's editor-at-large and Press Box columnist. He's calling for a press boycott of the conventions. Jack, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Isn't there an argument to be made for being there simply so that we can question the party talking points, analyze them, criticize them?
Sure, but you don't need 15,000 reporters to do that. And according to Forbes magazine, that's going to be the attendance. This is a little bit like the United States invading Grenada. You don't need several carriers, bombers, thousands of infantry to do a job that could probably be, you know, contracted out to the Kelly girls. I'm not calling for an absolute boycott.
All right, but when you say 15,000 is too many, what's too few? We can do a comparison with prunes.
I would not oppose every news organization that was interested sending one person. One person. So, you know, maybe 600 or 700 people show up to cover this thing.
PBS is planning to air complete coverage of both conventions. Do you think that's a waste of taxpayer money?
Of course.
But what about the fact that the networks are often accused of having a lack of civic consciousness for airing only 1 hour each night?
I think the networks, the broadcast networks, started cutting back their coverage to practically nothing because the event itself is a scripted event designed to be devoid of news. The news organizations have to, especially in these days, have to perform some sort of triage on their news budget. Better that they call back reporters from covering stories in Iraq to cover this pageant.
But I still come back to my previous question. If 15,000 is too many, given the possibility of good stories outside the hall, given the, I think, value of covering the pageantry to some degree in the hall, the possibility that something terrible could happen. That's why we have reporters covering every presidential event since the Kennedy assassination.
Imagine if the Macy's parade went on for 4 days. Would you advocate that we down in Washington send reporters up there because there might be some news?
What about the argument that local stations want to cover their local delegations?
Doing what? Better that they should spend the money writing about what the state legislators and the federal legislators are doing. The reason journalists want to go, Brooke, is that it's a great party for them. There's lots of free booze. There's lots of free food. If they covered the campaign, it's a kind of reunion. Hey, good to see you again. And I say an end to it. Andy Ferguson made this observation a couple of years ago in the Weekly Standard that the conventions have basically become journalism conventions. And his great one-liner was that the parasite has become the host.
So you suggest that news outlets send sports writers to cover the convention. What can they do that the rest of us can't?
They can write entertaining, interesting copy from a new perspective. They can see through the bull feathers that a national convention really is. They've not been co-opted by the process.
Sports writers frequently write stories about games that are foregone conclusions.
Yeah, but every sports writer, even if he's writing about a blowout baseball game, he'll find something interesting about the third inning or about the ejection of a manager. Tell me, Brooke, you're a news professional. How much time have you budgeted during both of those conventions to watch the coverage and to read it in your daily newspaper?
I have to say that, like the polls indicate about much of America, I am more engaged in this election than I have been in some recent ones. In the past, I haven't devoted much more than an hour a night to the conventions, if that. This one, I might actually have some genuine interest in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the honest truth.
This is the first time I've ever doubted your judgment in the whole 25 years that I've known you.
Let me ask you, have you ever been to a convention?
Of course not. Of course not. For the last 30 years, when there's no contest. Remember what you said at the top? There's been no serious contested nomination since Reagan took on Ford in 76. So why go?
Jack, thanks very much.
Anytime.
Jack Schaefer is Slate's editor at large, and he writes the Press Box column. An age-old competition has played out at the Olympics, and it's not the pommel horse or the uneven bars or even the human steeplechase. It's the battle between those who think the games should include news and those who believe they should be solely inspiring celebrations of sport. Certainly, NBC has done well with and by the games. They've earned higher ratings than the previous two Summer Olympics and won the network ratings war by margins not seen in decades. Variety reports that nearly 200 million viewers have seen at least part of NBC's coverage, which has included breathless reporting on some of China's biggest, and by big we mean enormous, attractions, including this segment on the Three Gorges Dam.
The dam is 1.5 miles wide and 60 stories straight down. You're probably wondering the same thing I wondered when I first saw the dam. Why not just use beavers? How many people did it take to build this dam? Did you use any beavers?
You have to twist yourself into knots to get these things without mentioning they forcibly removed 1.5 million people in the path of the dam. They just forced them off their land and sent them to the countryside. Just a sentence.
That's Paul Fari, staff writer for The Washington Post. He's been watching the Olympics with a fan's fervor. But after a week or so, he got the sinking feeling that he and millions of others were missing out on some of the biggest stories surrounding the Beijing Games.
You know, the stories I'm talking about, pollution and protest and China's place in the geopolitical system, I think we're all adults. We're all mature. We could handle a little bit of that kind of context.
But NBC has been reporting the real news on the Nightly News with Brian Williams. Doesn't that coverage count?
It certainly counts. But the Nightly News reaches perhaps 8 million viewers a night, people very interested in the news, obviously. The Olympics are reaching about 30 million viewers on average.
You know, the reason why those 30 million people tune in is to watch the games. To put news there would be like sneaking a report on the subprime mortgage crisis onto American Idol. I mean, it's a worthy cause perhaps, but it's essentially patronizing, like sneaking medicine into ice cream.
Well, there's no question the Olympics are escapist television, but that's not all they are. They're connected to a lot of themes and a lot of events that have gone on around them, for instance, the torch relay. And in fact, by excluding these things, NBC has given an extremely false view of what is happening in China. It has gone out of its way in some ways to propagandize the image of China.
Well, there has been a little criticism baked into the coverage. And there have been frequent references to the Chinese athletic farm system where young athletes are taken from their families and trained by the state to compete. That's a way of noting that this system isn't like ours.
Yes, and I found that very interesting because it begged the question, really, how is their athletic system different from us? Which, of course, would lead you to the questions, how is their government different from ours? They really have stopped very short on NBC of telling you about the very things that they've raised kind of parenthetically.
Well, we do know that that little girl was swapped out for another one during the opening song. We all know that the TV presentation of the fireworks was ginned up.
We do because the rest of the news media covered it, but not NBC.
But that's the point, right? It's out there.
Yes. So what is NBC so afraid of? And I'll tell you what it's afraid of. It's afraid of letting the real world intrude on the fantasy that it has created around the Olympics.
And you've written that NBC has been cautious to a fault because of the vast amounts of money that they've invested in the games. And, you know, this did sound a little conspiratorial. What's the problem with their purchase of the rights to broadcast these games and the games in 2010 in Vancouver, the Winter Olympics, and also the 2012 Summer Games in London? How does that stack the deck for the coverage?
there's absolutely nothing wrong with them purchasing those rights, but there are certain kinds of understandings about the ways in which you will present the telecast of the event that you bought the rights to.
Is the risk here that you bum out the viewers by showing the dark side of these nations?
Yes, I think that's exactly the risk. And when you do that, you don't bring the viewers in the state of mind that the advertisers would like them to be in. You don't want them agitated and asking questions about the political context.
There was so much criticism of the choice of Beijing to begin with that I think a lot of people wouldn't be happy with the coverage no matter how critical it was. People were just offended by the choice. Do you think that this might be part of your dissatisfaction?
I don't have a particular problem with Beijing getting the Olympics. But once you award the rights to a particular place, I think all bets are off. You open yourself and your society and your history to scrutiny by the people who are coming to your country. NBC is coming to China to cover the Olympics, but NBC is also coming to China to tell us about China. For instance, every evening we see Bob Costas sitting in front of the Forbidden City with a huge picture of Mao looming over his shoulder. Well, who is that guy? And maybe, Bob, you want to tell us a bit about Mao?
I can't argue with that. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Paul Fahrey is a staff writer for The Washington Post. He's been writing about the Olympics at the Playback blog on WashingtonPost.com.
As we review a nation growing at an astronomical rate, I'm appropriately assisted by one of the world's tallest men, Mao Zedong, and his lovely wife.
Ni hao, Mr. Bao.
Ni hao, Mr. Bao.
All right, let's start with the Great Wall of China.
Coming up, the abomination, abomination, and the chattering class weighs in on the twittering class.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ah, me, another August, another presidential campaign, another bestseller attacking the Democrat. Think back to 2004, when the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth's book, Unfit for Command, painted Senator John Kerry as a liar who had fabricated his own war record. Now it's The Obamanation, written by Jerome Corsi, one of the co-authors of Unfit, that tops the New York Times bestseller list. Like the previous book, it contains incendiary charges, in this case that Obama is a radical with links to Islam. But here's where the parallel storylines diverge. The Swift Boat story had plenty of time to damage Kerry's campaign before it was debunked. The Obamanation, by contrast, has been bashed from the start as little more than lies and innuendo. So what's changed? Eric Bollert, senior fellow at the Liberal Media Matters for America, says there are two reasons the book hasn't made the same splash. One, which we'll get to in a minute, is that the media landscape has changed. The other is that liberal watchdogs like Media Matters learned from the Swift Boat affair.
And they sort of bowed, you know, in this melodramatic Gone with the Wind moment, you know, never to let it happen again. And so we have new platforms, we have new voices, and we have new infrastructure to make sure it didn't happen again. And I mean, Media Matters literally fact-checked every page of this book almost on the day it hit bookstores. And I think it really put a blanket on the book and on Corsi and let the press know, look, this is not a legitimate book. He's not a legitimate author. So the press is on notice this time.
But it wasn't just groups like Media Matters. It was the campaign itself. You didn't have in the Obama campaign the kind of Hamlet-like agonizing over dignifying things with response that you had in the Kerry campaign.
Frankly, the Kerry campaign was naive. They thought the press was going to do the fact-checking when it came to the Swift Boat. And unfortunately, they paid a pretty stiff penalty for that naivete. So the Obama campaign learned from that. They issued a 40-page document last week. And this time the press did not get sort of sucked into it.
When we get to the other big change that you mentioned, the media market, what we're really talking about is the fact that Fox News doesn't dominate cable news the way that it used to.
No, if you go to summer of 2004, Fox News was really at the pinnacle still of its rating dominance. MSNBC and CNN were still very much following in Fox's wake. They didn't want to be seen being left behind. So when Fox News had John O'Neill, the Swift Boat author, on night after night after night.
John O'Neill, as you say, was co-author of the Swift Boat book with Jerome Corsi.
Sure. Eventually CNN and MSNBC sort of jumped in as well. If you fast forward 4 years, Fox is no longer the dominant ratings champ. In fact, CNN was the ratings champ in the first quarter of 2008, first time anyone has done that since 9/11. And CNN and MSNBC, particularly in campaign coverage, I think, have realized we don't have to follow Fox. They don't set the narrative. And in fact, when they produce a smear campaign like this, we're going to fact check it. We're going to be the counterbalance. And that's what we saw when Corsi had been on Fox several nights as given an unobstructed platform to talk about, you know, allegations he wanted to float about Barack Obama. And then his first appearance on MSNBC a couple days later, and anchor Contessa Brewer sort of really put him on notice.
You say it's a comprehensive look, and yet there are already online bloggers that are going through this book page by page and picking apart what they see as factual errors. So if they're going through and they're finding all of these factual errors in your book, why should we give you the credibility?
Well, let's talk about the journalists then, those 24-hour cable news shows and the newspapers that in 2004 claimed to be taking the high road by not taking sides. Why did that position change? Surely it's not just about the fading dominance of Fox News.
Well, I think there is sort of some collective penance going on here. I think the press realized that they did fail in a miserable way in terms of the Swift Boat coverage. Look, Len Downey, who was then executive editor of the Washington Post, was asked in 2004 about the Swift Boat coverage. And he basically said, look, we're not judging anybody. We're not judging the Kerry campaign. We're not judging the Swift Boat accusers. We're just putting facts in the newspaper. And excuse me, if you're in the middle of a presidential campaign and there's a well-funded, well-orchestrated smear campaign launched, it's up to the press to, you know, look at the credibility of the people making the charges.
I'm just wondering if the political balance changes again, and with the infrastructure shifting perhaps to the progressive side, will we see the emergence of these same cozy havens like Fox given to liberal liars the same way they've been given to conservative liars?
It's possible. Critics on the right say, well, MSNBC is just like Fox. They're no different. Their primetime lineup leans to one direction. We are eons from, trust me, in terms of MSNBC ever mirroring or adopting the Fox News blueprint for news and blueprint for propaganda, frankly. In theory, it's possible, but we don't see any clues of it on the horizon as of right now.
Eric, thank you so much.
Okay, good luck with it.
Eric Bollert is Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. The failure of the Obama nation to make the same splash as its predecessors says something about the current media and political landscapes, specifically that nobody is fact-checking. Charles Kaiser pointed this out. He blogs about the press for Radar Online. His blog is called Full Court Press. Charlie, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So your recent post was called The End of Nonfiction, which is a bit of eye-catching hyperbole, but you're not saying that in the good old days, publishing houses were paragons of fact-checking, were you? What's really changed?
Well, I think serious publishers like Simon & Schuster were at least concerned that they were publishing authors who were trying to get their facts right, and I think it's perfectly obvious that in this case, this imprint of Simon & Schuster, Threshold Books, under the tutelage of Mary Madeline, the Republican operative turned publisher, couldn't care less about whether the facts are accurate or not, because several things that the author says are directly contradicted by things that Obama has written or said, very easily checkable. And they weren't interested in a fact checker because the author says the purpose of this book is to defeat Obama. And as a result, he's willing to take any fact or non-fact, as the case may be, and put it in the book.
So you say that Simon & Schuster in particular ought to hang its head in shame because it has a legacy of good fact-checking of extraordinary nonfiction in such books as, say, All the President's Men?
Yeah, all the kinds of books which are published by Alice Mayhew, who is Miss Nonfiction at Simon & Schuster and who obviously would never have anything to do with a book like this and who tells her friends that there is a firewall between Threshold, the imprint which published this book, and the rest of Simon & Schuster.
Now, you're saying that this is clearly a political book. Mary Madeline, the former aide to Vice President Dick Cheney, says that it is not a political book. She says, rather, it's a piece of scholarship.
Yes, for which I bestowed upon her the 2008 Chutzpah Award of Full Court Press.
Now, polemical tomes like these have proven to be really good business for imprints all across the political spectrum,
and
especially the right-wing spectrum. Regnery Press, for instance, has had a string of bestsellers by putting out polemics.
Well, obviously, Simon & Schuster had Regnery envy. They saw all these books selling in the tens or even hundreds of thousands of books, and they wanted a piece of the action.
What's really hard is to try and guess what the impact is or will be of this book and of the debunking of this book. As some people have noted, you know, Ron Paul's book was at the top of the bestseller list, but it didn't move the population to vote for him. Maybe the bestseller list doesn't really serve as a particularly good dipstick of public mood.
Well, and so far, there's no reason to believe that this is an authentic bestseller, because even though it appeared at number one, it appeared at number one with a dagger, which the New York Times explains means that the bookstores reporting to them are reporting bulk sales of this book. And that means that they're using a very old strategy of just trying to figure out which books are reporting to the New York Times list and then sending people in to buy the book in droves. So it could be completely phony. We also don't really know how many books are out there. As usual, as all publishers do, they've given a variety of estimates from between 300,000 and 425,000 of how many they've published. My guess is it's a lot closer to 100,000. The only hard number we have is from the Nielsen Book Scan, which says it sold about 40,000 books in the first week.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Charles Kaiser writes a blog about the press and politics for Radar Online called Full Court Press.
Some 60,000 of Barack Obama's supporters would learn of his vice presidential pick via Twitter. This month, when the House recessed and the microphones and lights were switched off, Republicans who stayed to protest the Democrats' energy policies did not do so in silence. Their BlackBerries worked, so they Twittered. It's been a couple of years since the launch of the social networking service called Twitter. Basically, users post 140 character or less messages to cell phones or computer screens that supposedly answer the question, "What are you doing right now?" You can monitor the posts of the people you follow, and the people who follow you can monitor yours. Companies like Dell, Whole Foods, and JetBlue Twitter their customers. NASA's Phoenix Mars lander Twittered as it made its way to the red planet this spring. One Minneapolis couple used Twitter to give second-by-second graphic updates of their daughter's birth. Clay Shirky is the author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. He Twitters. Clay, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Don't take this the wrong way. As much as I like you and respect you, I absolutely don't care moment to moment what you're doing or what your passing thoughts are.
Fair enough. There is a small group of people who you are interested in. They're kind of, you know, what are you doing now? Your friends and your family. There are a lot of people, I see them once every 6 months. All of a sudden on Twitter, I'm getting some sense of what Matt Jones's life is like day by day. The other thing is that a lot of the uses of Twitter aren't actually answering the question, what are you doing now? People are, in fact, using it sometimes to ask questions. Right? A friend of mine just said, essentially, I can go any place on the Eastern Seaboard for a week vacation. Where should I go? Right? So he was asking his friends for advice. There are people who say something only once every 3 or 4 days. I've unsubscribed from people who are either too prolific or too banal or both. Right? And so a lot of it actually comes to the listener choice of who to listen in on.
It still strikes me as being a bit pathological. If Twitter goes beyond 200,000 users to 200 million users or more, it would probably have some fairly substantial implications for how the culture will evolve. Do you have any thoughts as to what hyperconnectivity might mean?
Well, periods of hyperconnectivity are typically followed by periods of disconnection. The economic logic of all of these services is get as many users as you possibly can, for obvious reasons. But for the users, right, the early days of a service where it's dense enough to be interesting but not so dense that it feels completely crowded is a big part of the appeal. So once the service gets large enough, you have to start being really choosy about both when you send out a message and when you receive a message.
Like Yogi Berra says, nobody goes to that restaurant anymore. It's too crowded.
Any communications medium can suffer from that problem. And by the time Twitter or something like Twitter gets to 200 million, it's going to have that problem.
I gather that the brevity demanded by Twitter has created something along the lines of connectivity haiku. People are forced to be quite succinct. How important was the 140-character limit to the success of this application?
I think it was enormously important, and even though it was designed for mobile phones, people have taken to the 140-character limit on the web. There's a certain relief, right, in being forced to write short form. When you're writing an email, right, you can end up agonizing over it and so forth. But if you can only say one thing, if you can only, you know, manage a sentence or even a sentence fragment, it really makes you concentrate on what it is you're wanting to say. There are actually Twitter comedians, right? There are people who are just trying to reinvent the one-liner for the 21st century. So already you're starting to get different styles of Twittering, even within this highly locked-down medium.
Okay, Clay, one last thing. Clearly, I'm talking to you on your cell phone. What are you doing?
I'm walking around Fire Island trying to find some place where people aren't ringing bike bells and driving by in little golf carts.
I'm sorry you have exceeded your 140-character limit. Clay, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Nice talking to you.
Clay Shirky is the author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. Julio Ojeda Zapata is the technology columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. He Twitters all day long. For him, it's a reporting tool, but that's just one reason he's into Twitter.
I've become fascinated by the haiku-like artistry that goes into composing a 140-character or less tweet. You'd be surprised at the substance, the heft of many of the conversations that are taking place in the Twitterverse. That's one of the reasons I like it.
Hey, try this one. Earthquake rumbles. L.A. wakens. All hell breaks loose.
That's how I found out about the earthquake right there. It's become a news feed for a lot of people.
When you send out a Twitter message, how many people receive it?
Currently about 715 people.
How did you get such a following?
Well, being a columnist at the Pioneer Press certainly doesn't hurt. But the key thing on Twitter is you have to get out there and mix it up. You have to be friendly. You have to engage other people. And that's the key. The primary thing I'm doing on Twitter is making friends, you know, just developing relationships. And the journalism part sort of comes along for the ride.
How many tweets do you send out on a typical day?
I don't want to know. Some days I don't do very many. Some days I do a lot. I'm literally in the 3,000 tweet range, and I've only been using Twitter for about a year, so I'm pretty prolific.
The mind boggles. Give me an example of a story that you were able to flesh out with the help of contacts made via Twitter.
Well, one story that comes to mind was about people that sort of can't leave their work at the office. They go on vacation, they take their laptops, and they continue working. Twitter users tend to be kind of workaholic, techie, social media, internet addict type. So this was tailor-made for that kind of an audience. So I put it out there and, you know, literally within minutes was getting responses from people who, in fact, happened to be on vacation with their laptops and saw my tweet and responded. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Now, you know, I got to say, while superficially it would seem that this really broadens your ability to get that kind of anecdote and to get sources for a story you're working on, I wonder if it doesn't actually have the opposite effect, narrowing your range as a reporter to the universe of your 715 contacts.
Your point is well taken. I have to be very conscious of the fact that this is a silo. This is one group of people. I can't overly rely on these people. I have to find sources by other means as well. I can't just do Twitter, but I can't overstate how wonderful this has been for me.
Now, you write about technology, and you know your audience probably overlaps more with a Twitter crowd than, let's say, your healthcare reporter's audience. Are your colleagues in the newsroom, the ones with the more old-school sort of beats, also embracing Twitter?
I'm the most prolific Twitter user in a journalistic context on my paper by far. For now, I anticipate other people will begin using it. But Twitter doesn't always work. Like, for instance, one of my colleagues, you know, she wanted to find people who had been affected profoundly in some way by the freeway bridge collapse, which happened about a year ago. And I put out a query on that on Twitter, and no responses. So you never know when Twitter is going to work or when it's not.
And how is your haiku artistry at this stage?
Still working on it, Bob.
Nice conversation. Many thanks. You're kind to join us.
I really appreciate it.
Julio Ojeda Zapata is the tech columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press and is author of Twitter Means Business, How Microblogging Can Help or Hurt Your Company.
Coming up, the geopolitical rewards of really good English. And press freedom pioneer, Pervez Musharraf. Seriously, China.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The crisis in Georgia and the breakaway region of South Ossetia continues, with Russia apparently withdrawing some troops on Friday but leaving others in place despite a peace plan brokered by French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Tens of thousands of refugees are in need of humanitarian aid. So far, the U.S. has flown 24 plane loads of aid into Georgia, but is barred from South Ossetia by Russian troops, now reportedly setting up checkpoints. It's been 2 weeks of misery that began with clashes between Georgian troops and South Ossetian separatists, escalating when Georgia launched aerial and ground attacks and culminating in a Russian invasion. There's plenty of blame to go around, but initially at least, the Western media let Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili define the narrative. Here's CBS's Katie Couric, CNN's Larry King, and CNN Headlines. Glenn Beck.
Mr. President, there are conflicting reports. Can you tell us what's going on?
Russian tanks ran through our towns, destroyed buildings, killed people, did ethnic cleansing of civilians.
Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. President. What's your overall reaction?
You know, I'm not shocked to hear it from former KGB operatives like Vladimir Putin. Those people come from the Orwellian world.
I am proud now to be joined by the courageous president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili. Mr. President, the last time we spoke, you know, I am a fan of yours. It was a happier time. What is the status of your country today?
We have this small, tiny democracy under attack from a giant neighbor, Russia.
Saakashvili is fluent, telegenic, and omnipresent. The Kremlin has complained that the U.S. was censoring criticism of the Georgian president, but especially in the early days of the crisis, there wasn't much criticism to censor. New Yorker editor and former Washington Post Moscow correspondent David Remnick says the reason isn't hard to fathom.
Well, he's pulled it off largely by the force of his own personality, his ability to communicate directly with the West, to go on CNN and speak fluent English. You remember the Israeli analogy, you know, that Yitzhak Rabin back in the day had a harder time communicating with the American public than Benjamin Netanyahu, even though Netanyahu's politics were much farther to the right than most Americans and most American Jews. The fact that a foreign leader can speak English sounds like a banality, but it really is a great advantage when trying to haul in American public opinion and also speak to interlocutors in Washington.
Well, the rewards have been quite rich for him. As you look especially at the early coverage of the conflict, the language attached to the Georgian military offensive was quite benign, and to the Russian response, why you would have thought that it was the invasion of Poland in 1939. How did the media get sucked into portraying the sides so differently?
Well, first I'd make a distinction between the news coverage and the commentary. And I think the news coverage, particularly if you look at the places that have a considerable presence on the ground, has been excellent. And it's yet another example of the so-called mainstream media spending the money and putting the talent in place to give you a picture of the world. And that is irreplaceable. The big difference comes in the commentary when you have people who have never been to that region, who've probably maybe been to Moscow once in their life, who God knows have never been to Georgia or South Ossetia, North Ossetia, never have experienced this and never studied the history of these conflicts. And so they reach for the first set of adjectives in the thesaurus, thundering tanks and all the rest, and the first set of historical analogies that they can possibly reach. And, you know, the good example is William Crystal in the New York Times invoking, not surprisingly, 1938. This was the most popular one for neocons to reach for the notion of Germany, the Sudetenland, Poland, all these analogies that are so familiar to us and that have become blunt political instruments that we remember well in the run-up to the Iraq War. And I find this kind of commentary really a disservice to the truth and utterly useless.
You just mentioned the historical context. This is not quite so simple as good versus evil. Can you somehow briefly tell us how the circumstances in South Ossetia became the circumstances in South Ossetia?
Well, there have been conflicts among these groups preceding the Russian Revolution in 1917, going way back into the Tsarist era. But in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States and the West in general took that as an opportunity to reap whatever geopolitical advantage it could, whether it was the expansion of NATO to include Poland and Hungary or the Baltic states or now the Czech Republic, or, you know, there are those who would defend ripping up even more recently the ABM Treaty. Taken together and viewed by Russia, remember, this was an empire. This was the big other in the world. It saw itself in a certain way, and suddenly it was spiraling downward. Somebody like Vladimir Putin, trained by the KGB, saw this as the great tragedy of Russian history. I don't think that Vladimir Putin, as dark a figure as he is in so many ways, has any notion that there's going to be a reconstitution of the 15 republics of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the idea that NATO is going to be coming to Ukraine causes him enormous anxiety and anger. Putin very much wanted a demonstration war, a war that could demonstrate Russia's willingness to use force so that places like Ukraine would think twice about a surge toward joining NATO and the Western sphere of influence.
Was South Ossetia Putin's Grenada, a made-for-TV war to restore confidence in Russia's military might?
Well, I don't think even the most ardent Republican had any illusion that the war in Grenada was one of fantastic military difficulty. Despite the imbalance between Russia and Georgia, a lot of blood, we don't know how much blood has been shed yet in the Caucasus in this instance, but it was not just a piece of cake for all sides.
Could Saakashvili have bet that what would take place is exactly what did take place in order to increase his sense of moral authority against the big bad Russians?
Well, you know, we're always cautioned in political science class and historical class not to overpersonalize these conflicts, but I've got to say that Saakashvili really irritated the hell out of Putin on a personal level. Somehow Saakashvili's personality, his attachment to the West, his image as a darling potentially of NATO and the American administration and foreign policy circles here really grated on Putin.
We've already established that you think the coverage on the ground by the major news organizations was quite good here, and that the commentary was a mess, ill-informed and two-dimensional and so forth. Well, what in the world can we do about that?
The problem is everything is what it is, as someone once said, and not something else. And when you have bogus analogies because they're easy and because they summon up the Nazis or they summon up Stalin, and because they are politically convenient in an election year to draw distinctions between Obama and McCain, it's damaging to the public conception of a reality that's far away and hard to understand.
David Remnick, a former Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post, is the editor of The New Yorker and also wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lenin's Tomb. David, thank you.
My pleasure.
On October 12, 1999, Pervez Musharraf, then head of Pakistan's army, seized power from Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif.
With all the normal institutions of political life disbanded, a television station was really the only venue left for a State of the Nation address. 2 days after imposing an emergency, Pakistan's self-appointed chief executive was ready to talk to his public. What everyone wanted to know was how, and for how long, the army intends to rule.
Turns out Musharraf's rule lasted until this week, when he resigned amid charges of corruption and threats of impeachment sparked in part by his crackdown on Pakistan's judiciary last year. Throughout his nearly 9 years in power, Musharraf forged a complicated relationship with his country's media. He was a dictator who paradoxically expanded media freedoms at the beginning of his rule, only to try unsuccessfully at the end to squelch the independent media he had helped create. But in his resignation speech on Monday, he claimed Pakistan's press freedom as one of his triumphs.
I'm also pleased to say that I'm leaving a vibrant media. I'm pleased to say that. And I hope that, with this independence, the media has functioned. With this, the media will enjoy the same level of freedom and independence.
So what is Musharraf's media legacy? The Christian Science Monitor's Shahan Mufti is based in Islamabad. Shahan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure.
Musharraf came to power in 1999 in a bloodless military coup, but a coup nonetheless, and almost immediately began expanding the opportunities for broadcast media. Was this because he had some sort of democratic tendencies, or because he was trying to create a cult of personality in the broadcast media, or some combination of the two, or some third reason altogether?
The fact is that even Musharraf's most vehement opponents admit to the fact that Pervez Musharraf in some way paved the way for a media boom. The democratic 90s, they weren't great times for the press, and journalists were being dragged out of their beds at night, and journalists were being fired from their positions for covering the wrong stories about the wrong readers. So there's little doubt, in, even within journalist circles, about what Musharraf had done. The reasons for it, though, are debated. Some people definitely thought that Pervez Musharraf was a leader for the 21st century, and he understood the importance of having his voice, his face out there. Some journalists say that he was obsessed with his own image, and he was. There's a lot of pictures of him out there fixing his hair, and he had gray wisps of hair on top of each temple.
And he even wore a different outfit depending on who the audience was.
You could never be sure what Pervez Musharraf would show up in. His choice to wear army fatigues or a suit, depending on his audience, and even depending on what political stance he was taking. So he had a good understanding, better than possibly any other Pakistani leader ever had to have, on how to deal with the image in the media.
I want to ask you about culpability. It seems to me that there was something of a deal with the devil going on here. The media, in exchange for its expanded freedoms, seemed to cultivate Musharraf's cult of personality, or at least create an environment in which a cult of personality could flourish.
Well, domestically, Musharraf was one who, like I said, he could put himself out there. So Pakistanis sitting in their living rooms would get to meet Pervez Musharraf's family. And no media outlet would say no to sitting in the president's living room, talking about his family escaping Delhi during the partition of India. I mean, really, it would be hard for any media channel to say no to that.
So in the face of the restrictions that he tried to impose under emergency rule, I guess the press became political allies of the judiciary, who had themselves been repressed by Musharraf. Was it awkward to watch this kind of advocacy journalism going on, even if it was in the name of press freedom?
It was odd. You'd see the insignias, the symbols of private television channels alongside political opposition parties on political opposition parties' posters. So you would see the face of the opposition leader like Benazir Bhutto or Nawaz Sharif. And next to them, you'd see these insignias of private news channels. One of them, actually, the Geo Television, that insignia, which was a blue, orange, and white one, became almost a badge of resistance to Musharraf, because that was one channel that suffered the most when Musharraf cracked down on the media.
So has the press begun any kind of self-examination into what extent they had been facilitators or enablers in his dictatorship?
I don't think that the press is at that point yet. There's still a lot of patting on the back and celebration. What the press is doing, though, is there's public service messages on some of these channels which are trying to frame a new sort of paradigm for themselves, in which they're saying that just because we may have helped the opposition parties, or, well, the government now, to get rid of Pervez Musharraf and eject him from the political scene, it does not mean that we have any alliances.
Shahan, there's one interesting footnote to this story, and that is Musharraf's own resignation speech, in which he credited himself for opening up the media. Was there any acknowledgement at all of the irony of that, that, you know, he had created this Frankenstein's monster which ultimately helped destroy him?
Towards the end of his rule, he obviously recognized what the media was doing. But he used that as a defense to show that he was, at the end of it, a Democrat at heart. He always said that he had created the media, which was hostile to him, yet he still tolerated them. He had helped create this monster that took him down in the end. One of the last things he said after he had announced his resignation, he talked about how he hoped that the media that he had helped create would continue.
Well, Shahan, once again, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Bob.
Shahan Mufti is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor based in Islamabad. He spoke to us from Lahore.
Coming up on Project Runway, in politics and in the fashion world, one day you're in, the next day you're out. This week, we're inspired by President Musharraf. His fiercely independent sense of fashion dictated when to wear the military uniform and when to take it off. Contestants, the challenge is to construct a look for a strongman that says, I'm not going anywhere.
All right, designers, you have until midnight tonight to complete your design. Okay?
One of you will be named the winner. And one of you will be out.
Go, go, go.
My inspiration is Castro, so I'm doing a baggy pant and belted jacket, and I found this great lightweight fleece. It's revolutionary meets tracksuit. I'm revolutionizing the tracksuit.
I think it's important to make it something different without being too shocking.
Right, yeah.
Growing up, my dad was kind of a dictator, and he also had really good style. So I'm really excited about this challenge. So I tried to fuse elements of Chairman Mao's tailored jacket and Iranian President Ahmadinejad's more casual, modern khaki windbreaker.
For me, that was my favorite.
It was impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gave the character, I think, a sense of power, but at the same time, it was very feminine.
I wanted to work with a retro palette, so I took my inspiration from North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. I have a very long, mustard-colored jacket with shoulder pads, and this little hat that I just love. It's my take on this bouffante hairstyle.
I think you ended up with just uninteresting.
If one of you would have to go home, who should it be and why?
This is an integrity issue, and I feel as a leader in this situation, I would be going home.
It was his idea to do a woman's outfit for Gaddafi, kind of sexpot despot, but I feel like all that fabric was bulky and cheap, so I think he should go. Sorry.
No, that's
Kelly. Your construction was questionable, but your taste level is leaving us questioning even more. You left us speechless today, and we wonder if you can ever step outside of yourself. I'm sorry, Kelly. That means you're out. Auf Wiedersehen. Thank you. All the best to you.
I wouldn't have changed a thing on my outfit. My dictator looks good. Maybe that frightened the judges.
Kelly, I'm sorry. I have to send you upstairs to clean up your space.
I think history will remember this differently.
If Project Runway Strongman Edition didn't already remind you of Project OTM T-shirt, then allow us to hit you over the head with it.
As promised, Bob has hosted the show topless to demonstrate his commitment to the project, which is mercifully drawing to a close. There's just 1 week left, so if you feel the muse, go to onthemedia.org, get the rules and regulations, and submit your design for our first ever On the Media T-shirt.
Next week, we'll have a winner, and we'll grill him or her on the air. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Nadia Zonis, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Michael Bernstein, our webmaster, is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from The Dial Press, publisher of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, a novel by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows that People magazine calls poignant and keenly observed, about love, war, and the immeasurable substance to be found in good books. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.